Hola, Su. So let's return very briefly to this intriguing statement by one of the great Gagyur masters, both a scholar as well as a great contemplative, Dapo Tashi Namgyel, when he states that people of sharp faculties are kind of invited to go to the meditation by way of the view, people of dull faculties to the view by way of meditation. It's an interesting, very provocative statement, I think a very meaningful one. I would add, first of all, though, that there are different ways of being gifted within the Dharma. Clearly, gift. Wangbo Nombo means sharp faculties. But this is, we call it gifted. Gifted. You have a natural ability. So there are people who are just naturally, in Tibetan you say geto, by their very birth, by past life imprints, momentum, and so forth. You have Mozart writing magnificent music when he's 10 years old, and so forth. So he was sharp faculties for music. Very gifted, okay? A prodigy, but just gifted is a nice term. Now, we know about that for mathematics, music, and so forth, but now within Dharma, my own sense is, my perspective, I think there are multiple ways to be gifted within the context of Dharma, and not just one. Just for example, within Dharma we say ke tsun zambo, ke tsun zambo, and that is ke means knowledgeable, erudite. It has a strong suggestion of very smart. These are the great ones like Lama Mipam Rinpoche and Gampopa and so forth and so on. So that's one way to be very gifted in Dharma. Pandita, kepa is pandita, right? But tsun has to do with your, it means noble, your dignity, your nobility, your depth, your gravitas. That would be very close to gravitas, you know. If you're a monk, you'd be just one of those spectacular monks, you know, or a nun, just so pure, pure soul. Really authentic, you know, like that. And then there's zombo, and that's just sheer goodness. Gets in zombo. Zombo yunde. So the qualities of just sheer goodness. Often, when you meet Khandrola, for example, I think if you have any perception like mine, mine's very ordinary. It's just kind of you have the sense of just being, wow, there's such purity there, such goodness there. And it's manifesting one aspect of that is just tremendous faith. Tremendous faith. Just spontaneously flowing like a water from a spring. But of course, it's not just that. That's one beautiful kind of characterization. But some people are very gifted for visualization, and others not. Some people are very gifted doing the ritual practices, really know the ritual inside and out, and other ones not. And the list goes on and on. So briefly here, when Dapo Tashi Namgyel speaks of those who are gifted, that they're kind of encouraged to, or the path for them that's kind of designed for them, is to go to meditation by way of the view. I strongly suspect he's referring to those people who are very gifted for engaging with ideas, theory. It's very strong in theory, right? Whereas others, and so that would be the kepe yunden, the quality of pandita, you know, like a great Tsongkhapa, someone like that. Whereas Milarepa, when we think of Milarepa, very few people think, oh, he's so erudite. You know, he wrote 30 volumes and unbelievable erudition. People don't think that because he wasn't. I mean, he achieved enlightenment, but his avenue for going there was not going to the great monastic colleges and getting, you know, studying hundreds of texts and, you know, and so forth. It was just a straight, narrow, right into meditation. And of course, it got him where he wanted to go. And so do we really call Milarepa a person of dull faculties? Well, you can if you like. I mean, he became enlightened. I don't know how dull you are. Nobody's dull when you get enlightened. Nobody calls him dull. So I think it's simply where do your strengths lie. So let's linger just a little bit, because I want to get to meditation very quickly, but I think this is actually very relevant to meditation. In terms of approaching this nature of mind, the empty nature of mind, because that's where we are. That's what this is all about. By way of theory, there's widespread, but one cannot say totally universal consensus, but very widespread consensus in Tibet, that number one, among the four philosophical schools, Madhyamaka is the pinnacle. There's very widespread on that. very widespread. But then within Madhyamaka view, the view of Nagarjuna, systematized by Nagarjuna, then you have two major schools. And I won't go into detail here, but Svatantrika and then Prasangika. Prasangika. And so when I just finished translating all these essays in this anthology, the authors were just utterly adamant that there really is only one supreme way of interpreting the teachings of Nagarjuna, and that is Prasangika. It is following Chandakirti, Shantideva, and so forth. And this is accepted in the Nyingma tradition, and the Kagyu, and so forth. Really saying, you know, this is really it. This is the pinnacle. Right. So let's just linger there just for a moment, because this is all of a piece. And maybe you'll see what I'm weaving here. Prasangika. During all the years that I was training in Galupa, there's just no question. It's a stairway. You start with the Vaibhashika, the most basic, and then to Satrantika, Chittamatra, and then Madhyamaka, with Madhyamaka, they go to Svatantrika, and then Prasangika, and there it is. It's a stairway. And its culmination is Prasangika, and then you're finished. That takes you to direct realization of emptiness. What does the term Prasangika mean? And it means consequence. Consequence. So as I was translating these essays and just meditating, I kind of had a clearer sense of what that was all about. Because by and large, I've been trained fairly extensively in Western philosophy. At Amherst first, philosophy of mind, and then a lot of different types of philosophy. Philosophy of science at Amherst, philosophy of mind, etc. at Stanford. So no great expert, but you know, I've had some exposure. And here's how philosophy works, generally speaking. You meet with another philosopher who has a different view. So Hoses has another view, and I'm going to come in like a shark, and I'm going to first of all show you how your position is false, at least probably not entirely false, but you know, show you all the defects in yours, and I'll hammer you, showing you how you are defective, and then when you've completely deflated, you know, then I'll show you, and now here's why my position is correct. Well, philosophers have been doing that since Plato and Aristotle, but no, actually before then. Aristotle found fault with Plato, but then showed how his views were right. Okay, that's how philosophers make a living. And each one has to show, if you want to get a PhD in philosophy, don't say, gee, I think his philosophy is great. You have to make your own mark and show how somebody else is wrong, and that's why your dissertation is worthy of a PhD. If you just say, I just think everybody else is swell, you're not going to get a PhD. You have to disagree with someone. So this is generally how philosophy works. Indian philosophy, Chinese philosophy, Greek philosophy, and so forth and so on, right to the present day. Prasangika takes a different approach, and it may be unique. I don't know, because I don't know everything, but it may be unique. And that is they say consequence. And they also say kelemepa, that if you're prasangika, a tengurwa, you have no position, you have no assertion. You are free of assertions. It really kind of got to me this time. As I was translating it, you know, because you translate, I'm only translating what I finished now, translating about an hour and a half a day, and the rest is like, I don't know, 7.5 hours of meditation every day, something like that. So much more meditation, that works for me, a little bit of study and then lots and lots of practice. But here's how it works. I say this with pretty much confidence. It's quite interesting. And that is, you approach anybody you like, a Daniel Dennett, you know, very hardcore materialist, or maybe Bishop Berkeley, an idealist, you know, subjective idealist. You approach anybody you like. Anybody. Anybody at all. George Bush. Maybe not. But in principle, you know, anybody who wants to philosophically debate with you, he probably wouldn't. He'd probably want to just invite you in for a cup of tea and a pleasant conversation. That might be much preferable to everyone. But coming back to philosophy, whoever it is, you say, please tell me your position, Professor Dennett. He's a very intelligent man, very accomplished, highly respected, a man not to be disparaged, out of hand. Professor Dennett, and I think, you know, among philosophers, he's about as far away from Buddhism as you can get without becoming completely insane, you know. And so you say, what is your position? What is your position? And he'll tell you. He's written many books about his position. And the prasangika would say, aha, have I understood your position? You're saying this? Did I get that right? And if you're intelligent, you should be able to feed it back to him, something he did in fact assert. If that's your position, then this follows, doesn't it? And you're not saying according to Aristotelian logic or Wittgensteinian logic or fuzzy logic or non-Boolean logic. You're saying just according to your own logic, We're both rational people here. If you take that position, doesn't this follow? And if you're really good at it, you'll have that person's philosophy self-destruct. Give it enough time, and you're not taking any position at all. You're just saying, we're dealing with reason here, and I've read some very, very interesting essays by some very smart people suggesting that reason is actually universal. If you're Chinese, you're an Indian, you're a Greek, you're a Roman, you're a German, you're a South American, speaking rationally cuts across culture and cuts across time. And I think there's a strong case for that. I studied that a fair amount when I was doing my dissertation, that I think a strong case that if you're speaking very intelligently in one language and you translate it, it's probably going to be intelligent in another. Now, your views may seem totally bonkers, you know, silly, outrageous, but you're the faculty of reasoning itself. So, here's the deal. And that is, if from a prasangika perspective, you are debating with someone who's taking what is clearly nihilism, a kind of a nihilistic view, that it's going to just go off into sheer nihilism. It may start out as subjective relativism or constructivism or postmodernism, something like that. Hilary Putnam's very, very good at this. He said, okay, that's your position? Good. Follow it through, and that will just self-destruct into the person where the person says, if it's really followed your logic, I don't know what to say. Because my own position is completely self-contradictory. If you're a nihilist, it's going to tumble you right over there where I have nothing more to say. Right? If you're a substantialist, muparmawa, the meparmawa, the yupamawa. If you're a substantialist, and there are many, Richard Feynman. Richard Feynman was a very outstanding, brilliant physicist, no question about it. He was definitely, he thought those atoms were real. He said everything boils down to motions of atoms, human behavior and so forth. Okay, fair enough. Intelligent man. So, you're a metaphysical realist. Many, many people are. Philosophers, scientists, and so forth. Say, okay, you're a metaphysical realist. Good. State your position. Did I get it right? Okay, doesn't this follow? And you follow it, and it self-destructs. You find that if you just keep on with sharp logic, whether you're taking something on this side or that side, you wind up where you have to say, I don't know what to say. I'm out of bullets. Because my position just torpedoed itself. It's like being on a battleship and sending out a great big torpedo, and then it circles around and sinks you. But it was your own torpedo. And the consequentialist, the prasangika, just has, you know, whatever your short torpedoes you're shooting, has this gravitational field to make all of your torpedoes come around and torpedo yourself. And yet they don't have any ammunition at all. The consequentialist doesn't have any torpedoes. He just says, shoot your mouth off, go ahead. And I'll take everything you have and it will self-destruct your position. Whether you're on the side of reification or the side of nihilism, whatever it is, it's going to self-destruct. Hang out with me, follow the logic, and I'll take you there. And where it ends is in silence. If you've really followed it, this is not to win debates. I mean, they're cheap. I mean, who cares when somebody wins a debate? I mean, who cares? You know, just have another debate. But if you feel ready, if you're really a true seeker, and you believe in logic, His Holiness Dalai Lama really believes in logic. Most people, many people nowadays don't. They say, that's just intellectual. Pass the dope. You know, that's real. You know. But the Dalai Lama, he really believes in logic. You know. If you really believe in the power of reason, and you follow that through, the prasangika will take you to the point where the only thing left standing is the middle way. And that's where you transcend your position and go into a simple negation of just like that. That's where conceptual elaboration stops. Now we take this really close to the bone. Let's bring it right back to the mind. Because we see here what this is a Vipassana. He could be analyzing space, time, matter, elephants, strawberry pudding, and so forth. He could be analyzing all kinds of things here, as Nagarjuna does in his Mula Madhyamaka Karika. He has these whole list of categories of different types of phenomena, and one by one, he's just showing each one is empty of inherent nature. Every single one without exception. There's nothing left. He's like a man who's gone into a forest and just cut down the whole forest. There's nothing standing. There's not one category that still withstands his analysis. Yeah. That's one way of going about it, right? But that's not what he's doing here, Kamachame. That's not what the Mahamudra tradition is doing. That's not what Dzogchen does. But this Mahamudra, let's stick on Mahamudra. And that is Mahamudra is just going right for the mind. We'll see why later. If you read ahead, you already know. But it goes right for the mind. It's a really cunning strategy. Now, I know this is corny, but I'm going to say it because you know I'm not afraid of corny at all. So this, I know it's corny, but I like it. Star Wars, Episode 3. The Death Star. You saw how nasty it was. They blew up a whole planet. Remember? All the screams from like 5 billion people. That was just kind of trial run to see whether the gun worked. Remember? That's nasty. And so they know that, you know, the bad guy got something really, really nasty here. So you got the Death Star. You know you've got to get rid of it because it's really awful. Right? You got two approaches. Bring in an armada, a whole fleet of maybe 1,000 or 10,000 vessels, and have them surround that bugger, and then just hit it with everything you've got from all sides. So the Death Star is going, you know, and you just hammering it, you know, with 1,000 missiles coming in from all sides until after a while, you know, the infrastructure's just got to give. And then it's going to go. That was pretty good, wasn't it? That's one way. It will take a big artillery, a big armada. It will maybe even take 6 volumes of collected reasonings. And commentaries and sub-commentaries. But you will get the job done. Just bring in enough heavy armaments. And, you know, it's finite. It can only stand so much. And then it's just going to start to fall apart. Or you can be Luke Skywalker. And the Force can guide you. And you find that, one, first of all, you need to be like the Mahamudra people. You need to find, what does this bugger have a weak spot? It doesn't look like it, you know. Does it have a weak spot? Because it looks like it's like titanium all the way around. But of course, with your keen insight, you see it has one weak spot only. But that means you have to get down that tunnel. And then you need to fire the missile, just one missile, but right to the sweet spot. And the Force has to be with you. And that one missile in the sweet spot, of course, makes a great fireworks display. The missile, the target of the missile, the sweet spot, is the all-creating sovereign. The all-creating sovereign. It makes sense. It makes totally good sense. If you can nuke the all-creating sovereign, then you have implicitly and kind of evidently nuked everything created by the all-creating sovereign. And that's everything. But that means you're going to have to be very cunning. And you can't just bring in 1,000. You need to bring in one that really knows how to use that stiletto, knows how to guide that one missile you'll send. Right. So we're going to see in the next 8 pages or so, these missiles coming in on mind. Where is it? What are its characteristics? Where does it come from? Where does it go? Is it really there? Is it really not there? Is it the same? Is it the same as thoughts? Is it different from thoughts? Is it the same as the mind that's directing the mind? Are there two minds, one being directed and the other one directing? Is the non-conceptual mind the mind? If the non-conceptual mind is the Dharmakaya, then do you have two parts, one Dharmakaya, the other? I mean, it's coming in from multiple angles here, but it's all coming in on one target. That's the sweet spot, because it's all about mind. He's not analyzing a sprout. You could, but he's not doing. He dispensed with the body really quickly, right? And kind of to say, "Am I in here? No. Okay, next." And then it's going right to the mind, right? The sweet spot. It's all about finding that sweet spot and sending right in the guided missile. So we have two approaches. I'm going to end on this point, I think. We have two approaches. The approach of those who are philosophically gifted, that's what I'm going to say. And not everybody is, but some people are spectacularly. And if you're philosophically gifted, I've met people like that, where they really know how to wield the sword. They're smart. They have analytic abilities. They have good memories. They know how to stand up in a good fight. They know how to really probe. You know. Now, that's actually only one part of the equation, because if you study Chandrakirti and a guide to the middle way, the Madhyamaka Vitara, he points out, I think it's in the chapter 6, he says, if this tool, this Madhyamaka Vitara, this guide to the middle way, if this is going to be effective in actually taking you to the point of being an Arya and severing your mental afflictions, you need to have more than smarts. You have to be more than intelligent. Remember? Check it out. Faith. Compassion. It has to come with something else. So there's no question about this. What I'm about to say is true. There are really smart people who've studied Madhyamaka, and they write books that are very smart, and they can talk smart, and they can debate smart, and none of the arrows hit the target. And I'm not mentioning any names, so, you know, I'm just saying this happens. It does happen. It happens in Western academia. It happens in Eastern academia. You're smart. You can talk the talk. You just don't have any arrows in your quiver that actually are striking your own mental afflictions. That definitely happens. It happens especially if you study, 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 and as you're studying, you're not thoroughly integrating your studies with your practice all the way along. That's almost a guarantee you're going to screw yourself. And you can write papers and get in and get a job teaching and talk the good talk. But you're screwed. If you follow that trajectory very long, probably you're going to not get anywhere at all. So here's a major point from Prasangika. When we're talking about mind, and whatever language, but it has to be what I really strongly suggest, your native language, the one that you feel, right? Not the one you keep on interpreting into your language, the one that is your language, whatever that may be. You got to find the word or words that most closely correspond to mind. Mind. But it's not trying to find the Buddhist concept of mind, it's trying to find your concept of mind. That's the deal. We're not trying to discover the emptiness of the Buddhist concept of mind. What did Nagarjuna have in mind when he said mind? Let's see whether that's truly existent or empty and inherent nature. That's not it. That's not going to take you anywhere at all, because Nagarjuna's view of what the nature of the mind is and whether it's deluded or not is not the root of your suffering. You didn't even know what Nagarjuna had in mind. You didn't know what the word citta means, or sem, and so forth and so on. So that's not the root of suffering. What did the Buddha say about the mind? Is it empty or not empty? Whatever. Because that is not why you were suffering when you were 5 years old, and 10 years old, and so forth. So why are we suffering whether we ever learn anything about Buddha Dharma? Because of our own notions of what we regard as our own identity and our own minds. That's why we're suffering. And it doesn't matter. What if you say, but maybe my understanding of mind is wrong. Maybe I'm Daniel Dennett or I'm somebody else. You know, maybe if I refute my view, then that doesn't help because I'm completely deluded in the first place. You have to work from where you are. So if you believe the mind doesn't exist at all, then you have to get over that. We'll help you out. Shake you out of your stupor. You know, insult your mind a little bit. That might help. Because they know, what do you mean? I'm not that stupid. Oh, you're intelligent, are you? Then you have qualia, don't you? You know. You have to start where you are, whoever you are, whether you're a nincompoop or brilliant, but we do have a sense of having minds. We do, in various languages. So you have to take your own. There are no nincompoops here, but you have to take, when you think, my mind is, and then you say anything. My mind. I have one. And you probably have a sense, it's not one of those enlightened ones. Probably so. You probably didn't come here already thinking, I wonder if Alan can help me with my Dharmakaya. The answer is definitely not. You know, that I can answer that question. And so you need to come in with your own understanding of mind. And whatever that is, whatever it is, sharp, sophisticated, dull-witted, whatever it is, the one that you are actually identifying with and taking seriously, and most likely, almost certainly, reifying. So it has to be your definition of mind. Right? And then you start probing into that, investigating into that. Right? So when we are approaching this as a pandita, as a person of sharp faculties, we are taking on this challenge from the perspective of a coarse mind. Coarse mind, that's what we deal with. That's where we live. Dualistic, coarse mind, totally enmeshed in conceptualization. Normal, right? Dualistic grasping. Saturates everything we think about. And so we're coming in from that perspective. And from that perspective, if you're young and you're philosophically gifted, it might really be worth your while to go off and spend 4, 6, 8, 10, 20 years studying Madhyamaka, and just working, and then working it in, working these ideas in, the reasonings, the analysis, and so forth, and working this into your worldview until you really are getting greater and greater and greater clarity from the perspective of your coarse mind, that you're really, it's shifting your viewpoint. For my own teacher, Geshe Rabban, that clearly happened. You know, he went through those 4 years of just studying Madhyamaka, and he was such a superb student and very philosophically gifted, greatly gifted in debate. It shifted his view. Geshe Ngaman Taige, the same. Really a smart debater. When they had the annual debates in Dharamsala for year after year after year, at the Munlam, the New Year's, they would call two of the best debaters in all of Dharamsala to match off, and there would be like hundreds and hundreds, if not a few thousand people, attending and watching this debate. And it was not just a formality, it was a real debate with the Dalai Lama right there. And year after year, Geshe Ngaman Taige was one of those chosen. And the other person, another of my teachers, Gyanlosan Gyatso, from the Buddhist school Dialectics. And they would match off. You know, I mean, it's a spectacle. It's fun. It's entertainment for really smart people. And the rest of the people, But His Holiness is there, you know, and they're showing their stuff. I mean, when His Holiness, on a micro level, the size of my thumb, of my pinky, back in 1979, His Holiness came to our monastery in Switzerland, Tapa Chuling. And we were told that he would give me this Dharma talk, for which I served as interpreter, but he came into the monastery, and Geshe Rabban told us to prepare. He said, His Holiness is going to come in, and he wants to watch you debate. Now, I was senior. I mean, this is just the, you know, karma. I was the senior Western monk at that time. I'd had more training. And so I needed a debating partner, because His Holiness would be watching me debate. And so I don't remember how it happened, but Geshe Rabban said, "You will not be debating with any of the Westerners here. There was a visiting Geshe. You'll debate with him." And so I said, "Okay, sure." I said. And then the Geshe came to me. It was really cute. The Geshe came to me and said, "Alan, tell me the question you're going to ask." Because I had a gnarly one that was so tough. It was like a titanium hammer. It was from what they call the iron bow of the Galupas, Lekit Nyingbo. Tsongkhapa's analysis of Chittamatra and Madhyamaka. And I memorized the first 90 pages of it. And I'd had Geshe Rabban's teachings. And I found a couple of points there that I thought, man, that's tough. You show me somebody can answer that one, and you got a really smart guy. So I pulled those out, and I was ready to launch these warheads at him. And then he asked me to show him my bullets before I could bring out the gun. I thought that was... So I did, and so. But His Holiness was watching our debate. A friend of mine photographed His Holiness in the background watching me in this Geshe debate, and it was like, I have the picture. He was really watching. So in any case, I'm diverging all over the place. But you can. But there it is. You take whatever view of your mind you have, and you push it, and you push it, and you push it. Until the only thing left is the middle way. You've not fallen into nihilism, that self-contradicts. You're not still holding on to substantialism, that self-destructs. The only thing left is no position, end of conceptualization, termination of philosophical position, emptiness. That's one way. That's one way. You need to be pretty sharp faculties for that. Because people can get bogged down, they can get confused, they can get depressed, they can get frustrated, they can get impatient. Oh, it's hard. It's subtle. It's really, really subtle. But there is another route. And that's where I will end. The other route is for people of dull faculties in this categorization of Dapa Dashi Namgyal. They may also be older. Maybe all of us older. And that is, you want to be kind of young to go for 4 years of training in Madhyamaka straight and really study and study and study. You want to be kind of young for that. It's for young minds, not so much for older minds. The other route, of course, is to the view by way of meditation. And that is the approach taken here. Because he's not going into these very, very elaborate, sophisticated syllogism after syllogism after syllogism. Where's the syllogism? Where is the syllogisms? This is Madhyamaka. Where are the syllogisms? And all he's saying is, look, examine, ask. And then he's saying, get back to me. And don't say, it's impossible to say. Wrong answer.
But flamboyantly long.
Yes, you were. He said it so well. I can just see somebody, you know, coming to a great Mahamudra master and say, you know, it's really hard to say. Or, actually, it's inexpressible. That's when you're on one of those seats that has a spring beneath it. Okay, you ready? Now, follow this route for people of dull faculties. Follow the route for people of dull faculties. Achieve shamatha. You're establishing a new perspective. Now, what Penjan Rinpoche says in his treatise on Mahamudra, and specifically on shamatha in the context of Mahamudra, which is precisely taking the mind as a path, settling the mind as a natural state, and or awareness of awareness. That's it. That's what he teaches. This is the shamatha route if you're on your way to Mahamudra. He says, when you've done that, you've achieved shamatha by this means, which means, keeping to Galupa terminology, your coarse mind is dissolved into the subtle continuum of mental consciousness, and you have achieved shamatha. Then he said, although there are a lot of misconceptions and misappraisals of this experience, I, Chukyi Gyantsen, tell you, you have ascertained the relative nature of the mind. You have ascertained that. Congratulations. That's not nothing. That's like discovering the Higgs boson. That's ultimate reality, but that's not a trivial discovery. You have now found out what is it about the mind that makes it the mind. You have now had a direct face-on encounter with the core defining characteristic of consciousness, and you'll know exactly what you're talking about because you're not talking about it. You're experiencing it directly. You've nailed it. You're home. You know it. You know you know it. You now know the nature of the mind on this relative level. Bare bones. And that's before the elaboration. Before the elaboration. Well, is it a Brazilian mind or is it an American mind? Is it a woman's mind or a man's mind? An old person, educated, smart, dull, artistic, creative, funny, boring? Those are all elaborations. That's all frills. That's all extras. When you shave off all the extras, even, is it human or is it chimpanzee? Is it primate or is it reptilian? These are more frills. These are more frills. These are conditioned by brain. What kind of a brain do you have? Reptile, fly, human, baboon? These are frills. These are add-ons. These are extras. When you've achieved shamatha, you've come down to the nucleus that is in common in its core features with any sentient being. Selsing Rigpa. It's luminous and cognizant. No frills, no additives. You've come down to naked mind, unadorned, unconfigured, settled in its natural state, and you're there experientially. So try to imagine. You've done the hard work, whether it takes months, years. You say, I'm a person of dull faculties. This is it. I'm going to follow this route because the other one's really not, it's not viable. This is it or nothing. You can either be this one or this one. You can come in by way of coarse mind, by way of conceptualization, and transcend conceptualization, or you can go in this route, transcend conceptualization on a relative level, identify mind in a transcultural way. It has nothing to do with your beliefs. Whether you're atheistic, plural, it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. This is not philosophy. This is like eating chocolate. Doesn't matter whether you're a communist or you're a fascist. It's chocolate. Taste of chocolate is chocolate. The taste of consciousness is the taste of consciousness. Doesn't matter what you believe before you got there. Doesn't matter whether you're a materialist. Doesn't matter whether you thought the mind is a brain. It doesn't matter at all. You can think it's turkey sausage. It doesn't matter. Because when we get here, you actually know what you're talking about. That's because you know before you talk about it. Right? But bear in mind this crucial point. When you're resting there, and I'm going to go back to Dzogchen terminology, substrate consciousness, when you're resting there, you've achieved shamatha, which means, having achieved shamatha, access to the first jhana, you have now at your fingertips, ready to play, all five jhana factors. And the two that I want to highlight are dōpa and jīpa, the ability to engage in coarse investigation and subtle analysis in a very quiet room. Unlike your coarse mind, you know what that's like, grand standstill station. Lots of noise. Here, you are in a quiet room with perfect acoustics. When you're just resting, you're resting in bliss, luminosity, and non-conceptuality. But you can, like flipping a switch or turning the ignition in a car, you can turn on your mind. You can turn on your conceptualization, your critical ability, and you can investigate. So what, when you are resting there and you turn on your mind, you turn on not your coarse mind, you're still resting in the substrate, but resting there, you can turn on these mental factors on a subtle mind level of coarse investigation and subtle analysis. Coarse is vitarka, subtle is vichara in Sanskrit. You can turn them on. So from that perspective, just try to imagine. From that perspective, now that you're resting in the essential nature of mind, and that's what Jujum Lingpa calls it, when you've achieved shamatha, and he said, oh, some people think it's Rochik in Mahamudra. Some people, it's Tudel. Whatever they think, I'll tell you what it is. It's the Semkingwo. Semkingwo means in Chetsare. Semkingwo Tanepe. Semkingwo. You have realized the essential nature of the mind on a relative level. Of course, it's not Rigpa. Hardly needs to be said. So we have this Dujom Lingpa, this inconceivable yogi with no teacher. And then we have the Penjin Rinpoche, incredible scholar, erudite, has many, many teachers, many, many, you know, the pundit, coming in from different centuries in different traditions, right on the same point. I mean, exactly the same point. So, when you're resting in there in the substrate consciousness, you can conceive. But your mind's not going blah, blah, blah. You can conceive when you want to, like when Andre Segovia starts to play the guitar. It's not obsessive compulsive, like, I don't know what came over me, you know. He starts when he starts and he finishes when he finishes, you know, and when he plays, it's magnificent. He's not like some screwball that I don't know how to play, but I'm going to just jam anyway, you know, just making a lot of noise. That's what our minds do, right? Well, when you're resting there, you pick up the guitar of your investigation and analysis and you play it. You play it. And now imagine from that perspective, when you think, my mind, what do you think comes to mind? Something very simple, something transcultural, something essential, which you are reifying. Because you've not tackled that yet. You're just practicing shamatha. In other words, you're ready to go in a very quiet room with a very sharp knife and get the job done quickly. Go with the force, Luke. Different approach. But the end game is the same. Because what you're doing here, as you're just looking court, we're going to see multiple perspectives here, but it all boils down to Jungne Dosum. So it's our Diran Resha, Chepa Chesa. What you're investigating here is, okay, mind. There you are. You got substrate consciousness, substrate. And when you want to think, you can. You can have thoughts coming up. You can have emotions coming up. but you're in this really cool lab, right? So mind, whatever mind is for you now that you're in this transcultural mode, where does it come from? Where is it? Where does it go? And when you're probing here now with your stiletto, it will take you right there. Where conceptualization stops. And you realize the empty nature of your mind. Okay? So you can put in years and years of training as a scholar and debating and so forth and so on. And then get to meditation. It'll come as a surprise to you that the skills you've been developing as a Kenpo or as a Geshe or as a PhD in religious studies are completely irrelevant to developing shamatha. Mm-hmm. It's like being trained for years as a medical doctor and saying, here's the garden, go for it. Like, you couldn't have told me that a bit earlier. It's an entirely different skill set. It's different. It's really, really different. And so, there it is. But either way, if you're taking this that he can summarize in, 10 pages? Enough to cut through and realize the empty nature of your mind. But this is for people who are taking the yogic route, more of the Milarepa route. Straight, simple, unelaborated. And a real boon of this, and it's a boon both ways, both of these have boons. There are so many wonderful geshes. I've trained a number of them, superb human beings. They're not just smart and erudite. They're warm-hearted, they're compassionate, they're patient, they're enthusiastic, they're generous, I mean, lots of them. They didn't just go through a dry intellectual training for 25, 30 years. Probably some of them did. None of my teachers are like that. None of the geshes I trained with. There are people I would want to emulate. I hope to emulate, right? So the training is not just academic. Western academia, that's different. That's different. I won't comment further on it, but that is different. Are there people who have PhDs who you would not want to emulate? Sure, sure. But that's different training. It's not Dharma training, that's academic training. It's different. So if one really is richly with strong faith and really coming in wholly into the more pandita route, it really works. It's worked so many, many times. Why even bother to criticize it? And can you do it poorly? Of course you can. You can do anything poorly. For the yogic route, as you're going along this path, it's going right to your nucleus from the beginning. It's right, going right to your core, isn't it? You've been seeing in the last 4 weeks. It's hitting you where you live, isn't it? I mean, I've spoken with 36 of you. It's getting where you live, wherever that is, whatever the issues you're dealing with, it's getting where you live. It's not giving you a vacation off to Tibet land or Prasangika land, someplace nice to escape to, which you can definitely do, or let alone Avalokiteshvara land. Oh, I'm a deity. Here. I mean, where you live, this is kind of like, it's hitting it. It's erupting it. It's like squeezing a bag and seeing stuff, juice, all over the place. I've seen your juice. I've been listening to your juice. It's where you live. And if this is done skillfully, the very process itself is not just when does it get good, will I achieve it or not, as in, when does Santa Claus come to town? But the path itself is good. And you should know that every day. If you don't know that every day, then you probably are not following the path. You need to know that today is good. Today, if I die tomorrow, today was good. Because you know it. Not because somebody sells it or because it's really rare or really precious, blah, blah, blah. But you need to know it's good. And so this very path itself is not simply do we achieve shamatha or not, but the very path itself is getting right to our core, right where we live, and transforming, purifying, bringing greater wisdom, greater compassion, greater goodness and virtue. Something like that. Okay, ready to practice? Let's do it. Find a comfortable position, whatever is most comfortable for you. Now we take time to settle down. A give all the words that have flowed through the mind, let them flow right on through into the past, and settle in the simplicity of the present moment, settling body, speech, and mind in the natural state. For a couple of minutes, calm the mind. It's probably been stirred up by all the words from the last 45 minutes or so. Calm it now. Breathing out, relaxing, letting go. With every exhalation. Let your eyes be softly open, your gaze vacant. Your body and mind at ease from the very core. Let your awareness be still. Unmoved by the thoughts of the future and the past, and cogitations about the present. Let's begin with the analogy of Galileo simply looking into the night sky with his well-mounted telescope, polished lenses in sharp focus, beginning as simply a stargazer. Simply look into the space of the mind and see what you see, without judgment, without labeling, without analysis. In the scene, let there be just the scene in this space of the mind. when you see somebody's face in a crowd, they say Mary, somebody you know. You see just her face, but very clearly you recognize her face. If someone asked, did you see Mary? The answer would be unhesitatingly, yes, I saw her. She's out on the crowd. I saw her face. I saw her. Her face is not Mary. Nevertheless, that is a valid statement. It's enough to accurately say, I saw Mary. I saw her face in the crowd. You don't need to see all of Mary. You don't need to see the Mary that possesses her body and mind and so on. So now we've been practicing shamatha focused upon the mind. Semna mibeshine. A single thought is not the mind. A single image is not the mind. But like seeing someone's face in the crowd and recognizing it, as you may legitimately say, I saw that person, likewise, in the same way, when you observe a thought, an image, a memory or fantasy, that's enough to say, I saw the mind. Are you observing your mind now? If you're looking in the right direction, and you're seeing thoughts and images, other mental events arise, the answer must be yes. What else would it mean to see your mind? So when you witness a thought or an image, anything coming to mind, now examine it very closely. We move beyond shamatha to vipassana, to a question, to exploration, investigation and analysis. When you witness some event on which you impute the label, mind, examine closely. From moment to moment, where did it come from? From nowhere? How did it get from nowhere to here, the space of your mind? How does something that is nothing, nowhere, become something here that you can observe? Examine closely, from thought to thought, image to image. Where does it come from? If you can't observe it, its transition from being nothing nowhere to becoming something here in the space of the mind, maybe that doesn't happen. So then examine the alternative that is coming from somewhere. And if it's coming from somewhere, it must have been something somewhere. So how is it that that something somewhere else transforms into something here in the space of the mind. Examine closely. Where did these mental events come from? And what were they before they were this? Examine the origins of the mind, or anything you designate as the mind, until certainty arises. Maybe this will be easier. Once a thought or an image has arisen, you're attending to it, you're observing it. Where is it? Where is it really? Is it really there in front of you? Which means you must know where you are, otherwise you wouldn't know what's in front of you. Perhaps there's a quiet, lingering image of yourself, an appearance of yourself here. Could be. Where's that? Inside your head? Outside the head? You can generate a thought if you like, a thought or an image. So you know when it's coming, you know where to look. And once you're looking, once you've found it, ask, where is it? Is it out there? Someplace in front of you? Or is it in here, where you are? Where is that? And where's the border? if you can't identify the location of the first thought or the second, try a third or fourth. If they're here, they must be somewhere. Where is here? You're observing them. Where are they? Which implies, of course, where are you? You have certainly noticed that none of these thoughts stick around forever. Sooner or later, they all disappear. That goes for thoughts, desires, emotions, images, everything here. Focusing for the time being on thoughts and images. When they do disappear, when they're no longer there, when they're vanishing, where do they go? Do they vanish right where they are? Do they withdraw into a point and disappear? Do they go to the left or right? Do they go away? Where do they go? Again, you can generate a thought anytime you like. And watch how it disappears and where it goes. Does it transform into something someplace else? Does it turn into nothing? Nowhere. then rest without thought, sustaining the flow of cognizance. So very briefly, and specifically for people listening who have a background in the Gelugpa tradition, where, as you know so well, your first task is to identify the object to be negated. Like a brain surgeon, you can come in and know exactly where the cancer is. Don't cut anything else out. Just take the cancer out. Leave the brain intact. Leave conventional reality, relative truth, intact. Don't mess with it. Mata macha. Without investigating, without analysis, without analyzing, relative truth, let it be. Da, che. If you engage in ontological analysis, nothing withstands that analysis. So you're refuting just the object of negation, and you're leaving unscathed, untouched, relative truth, right? With causality, dependent origination, and so forth. The approach is different here. You'll know there's not one reference to the object of negation. Not one. I've read it. Not one. And yet, this has been producing the results for centuries. So to say, oh, they're not doing it right because they're not following the Gelugpa approach. Well, I'm sorry. It's been working. The Gelugpas revere Milarepa as much as anybody else. And he was doing this. So here's the phrase that I've seen again and again in Dzogchen. That's where I've really seen it. But since the enormous overlap between Dzogchen and Mahamudra, I'll say this with confidence here. And that is, Nangji Madhupa. Nangji Madhupa. While appearing, it's unestablished. Not to be found. Or even, Nangji Mepa. Teyore. It appears, and it doesn't exist. That's different terminology. No Gelugpa would ever say that. No Gelugpa would ever say that the cup doesn't exist or the mind doesn't exist. They never say that. They say, oh, you've just wiped out relative truth. What are you, nihilist? I have to get you back onto the prasangic debating card. We have to slap you into shape again. You know. It's a different method. This is the yogic method. Different method. So let's see what his method is. Times, even though not inherently existent, is definitely passing. So we now go to the middle of page 91. The meaning of this, you can see before, where the primary tantra on the penetration of sound says, check out the initial origin, its subsequent location, and its final departure. That's it. That's the nucleus right there. That needs a bit of unpacking. Elaboration. Elaborate, please. The meaning of this is stated in the pith instructions on the clear expanse. So now we'll develop a bit more. But we'll see it goes on and on, because Gyatro Dhammache intersperses this in the smaller font with some commentary. He's going to really unpack this now. This is the real juice. This is the real juice. Okay, it's all juicy. We're going now to real core. So the initial investigation of the origin, location, and departure, my translation shifted slightly since then, this was 20 years ago. The initial investigation of the origin, location, and destination, that's what it should be, is as follows. Engage in discursive meditation, that is, activate your intelligence, activate your critical faculties, use thought. This is not just watching in a non-conceptual mode. Engage in discursive meditation, that's analytical meditation, and stabilizing meditation on each point, jekom and jokom. You're doing this alternate. You investigate and then you, it's like a skater. It's like a, you'll see a skater and then skating and then skating and then right? Just like that. It's very close. It's clear, isn't it? You can really go when you're just like that. Effort, that's when it's effortless. But you have to move those legs, get your momentum up, going back and forth. And regarding the initial, now with regards to the initial arising of the mind or the origins of the mind, perform discursive meditation, analytical meditation on externally appearing objects. The external environment, your place here, Gympie. I really wish they could have, I mean, we're doing really important stuff here. Imagine if we started here in Gympie instead of Phuket, they'd say, live from Gympie. It would have been a very different last 5 years. Like, this guy from California, it's live from Gympie, what do you expect? Okay, Gympie is what we got, Gympie. I mean, we're dull faculty people anyway, so maybe Gympie's a, maybe that's okay. Gympie people, you know, dull faculty people, come to Gympie. Okay. We're here. So, engage in analytical meditation on externally appearing objects. Well, your external environment, where are you? Its inhabitants. Earth, stone, rocky precipices, trees, grass, trees, forests, mountains, and hills. So he's writing this in Tibet. He's just given a description of a lot of Tibetan terrain. So look around you. What are you looking with your mind? Mind's arising relative to what you're perceiving there, making sense of. That's my grandma, and that's my dog, and that's my horse, and so forth. And so, in short, whence this arising of mind rising relative to all these objects that are populating the world around you. In short, whence did it arise? This mind. You're engaging with the environment, other people, and so forth, with your mind. Where did it come from? How did it come up? You can try this tomorrow morning when you're waking up. Especially if you wake up from deep sleep where you don't have a mind. And then you wake up. If you can, catch yourself. When you're just getting a mind, you're just starting to come to, you're starting to wake up, right? You're starting to have your mind. And of course, you're going to be aware of your bed, your room, and so forth, your body. Mind's coming from where? You know, like that. Or if you're a good napper, you can do this repeatedly. Take a nap, wake up, okay. Where's your mind coming from? Where's it coming from? When you're attending to, putting your mind to the environment. You're minding your environment. How did it arise? How did this occur? What was the manner of its origination? Investigate this with your intelligence, your prajna, analyze it well, and meditate. Investigate, analyze, meditate. The first two are analytical meditation or discursive meditation, and meditate is when you get some clarity, some insight, some opening here, then rest right there, be quiet, and just rest right there. This is why we've spent weeks in the practice of shamatha, which is basically a non-conceptual practice, doing this. Sustain the flow of cognizance when you're not mentally talking. When we're normally knowing things, we're talking our way all the way through, right? In business meetings, when you're doing artistic work and so forth, the mind is knowing, embedded in a conceptual network. And that's how we work. Well, This has to be sustaining a way of knowing that's not chatting at the same time. That's why we have the shamatha as a basis for vipassana. So investigate. That's a coarse one. Then analyze. The first one is topa. Then chupa. These are exactly, those two are two of the jhana factors. Remember, you're using those. So you can achieve shamatha and do this. Do it while you're resting in the substrate consciousness. Right? You can come out, take a look at the peak of your environment, and then go back in again. Investigate, analyze, and then pump, and then glide. Meditate is the stabilizing meditation, jokom, just placing your awareness. Okay? That's investigation. That's of the origin. Let's move on. Time's moving. Then investigate well where it arises. That is, once your mind, your thoughts, your images, whatever you're designating as your mind, when you say, I'm watching my mind now, good. Whatever you're attending to that you're calling your mind, whatever you're attending, not somebody else, you don't have to get the right answer. Whatever you're attending to, when you say, when you have that feeling, probably accurate, I'm observing my mind right now. Whatever that is that you're attending to, then ask, okay, good, you've got it, you're looking like a sniper, you're looking through your telescopic lens, I'm looking at it, I got it in my sights, I'm looking at my mind right now, good, don't shoot it, ask where it is. Don't blow your mind. When you're looking at your mind, good, when you like, I'm looking at Lena, okay, she's right over there, I know where she is. When you're looking at your mind, you're holding it, you got the target, good, now ask where is it. Is it really in front of you? Maybe what you're looking at actually is a thought, like somebody's face, a thought, good enough, right? Whatever it is it in front of you, really? How far? These are reasonable questions. If it's located in front of you, okay, is it a mile away? Is it 2 meters away? Is it centimeters away? Oh, by the way, away from what? Because all of that makes sense if and only if you know where you are. You can't say it's 5 miles from and then just stop. How do you get to Brisbane? It's about 13 miles east from, finish the sentence, please. Otherwise, it doesn't mean anything at all. I mean, if you were trying to get to Brisbane by saying it's 13 miles east, and that was the end of the sentence, then clearly you don't know where Brisbane is, right? So if it's in front of you, fine, but that presumes you know where you are. And then you can ask how far in front? Or if it's inside your head, good. Where's that? Where exactly is your head? And don't tell me it's on top of your neck, I knew that already. The head you're experiencing. You know, this is immediate experience. So the Pandita's route is very analytical. It's very smart. It's using that sharp sword of analytical reasoning, discursive thought, philosophical acumen, and so forth. This is radically empirical. There's a nice analogy there really quickly. One person I know only indirectly because I've read his writings with tremendous admiration, John Wheeler. David Finkelstein I know personally, theoretical physicist. Some of their insights, and they're theoreticians. I mean, they're sitting in their room. They got a blackboard. That's pretty much it. That's their, like Einstein. That's their lab equipment is a lab, you know. Einstein was asked when he got his position in Berlin. Now he's a big shot. You know, he's world famous. He got an endowed chair at Berlin. They didn't get any better back then. And there's a professor, and they gave him a great big salary, and they treated him like royalty. He said, Professor Einstein, what do you need? What equipment do you need to do your research? And he said, I need paper, I need a pencil, and I need a big waste paper basket for throwing away all the bad ideas. That's it. And that was literally true. For the theoretician, that's what you need, a pencil, paper, and a big waste paper basket. Right? Whereas if you're an experimentalist, like Anton Seininger, well, then you're talking big bucks. I mean, then you need a laboratory. You want a state-of-the-art laboratory. What's fascinating here is the insights from a person like David Finkelstein, or let alone John Wheeler, their insights into the emptiness of inherent nature of elementary particles is quite astonishing. And they get it because they're smart. They really know their theoretical physics, and they just push it and push it and push it. How do you think they toppled Newton by following the implications. They were prasangikas. And they're not nihilists. There's not a nihilist among them. There's not one nihilist that said, oh, the world doesn't exist. And you wouldn't keep your job. They would put you in a little tight little jacket, you know. So it's amazing how these really bright ones, Stephen Hawking, John Wheeler, and so forth, theoreticians who have pencil and paper, they've been able to draw on 400 years of momentum of physics and come to insights that are just not by accident similar. And then we have people like Anton Seilinger, who I do know, and he's an experimentalist. He is the experimentalist experimentalist. We've spoken at length, and he always is just saying, the evidence, let's just talk about the evidence. No, keep to the evidence. And that's what he does. He's in the laboratory. He's doing quantum teleportation. He's bending light in the laboratory. So when he invited the Dalai Lama, when he saw the Dalai Lama speaking on Madhyamaka and was saying, this is brilliant what you're saying, but I can show you in my lab how we've come to these conclusions. Would you like to come? And I'll show you how we come to the conclusion that when you look for the elementary particle as it exists in and of itself, you do not find it. It is not to be found. Would you like to come to the lab and I'll show you how we drew this conclusion? I think it was less than 1 second before His Holiness said, yep. And there we were a year later. Incredible. One of the choicest experiences of my life to be in the middle of that one. So here it is. Well, similarly, you get these geshes. They're the David Finkelsteins, for heaven's sakes. And these monasteries, they're a beehive of activity. They're noisy, have clapping sounds of clapping hands all over the place. You know, there's nobody asking what's the sound of one hand clapping, because they're all clapping too. And it's very noisy. So they're very, very busy. I mean, go to Tsongkhapa Institute. Busy place, yeah. It should be. It should be. But that means they're not spending a whole lot of time in silent meditation. Because you can't. It's too noisy. But then you go to, you know, a Tupta, some meditation retreat center, and there, you don't know anybody's there. It's totally silent. Right? So you can come in the yogic route, the experimentalist route, that's what I'm saying. You can come in the experimentalist route, and you can get there. You can come in the theoretical route, and you can get there. The geshes and the yogis. Smart faculties, dull faculties. So investigate where it arises and how it is present throughout your own body. If you think this mind is somewhere in your body, okay, and throughout your own body, in the upper, is it up here in the head, maybe the throat, the heart chakra? Is it lower, down by your guts, your butt, your feet? In the limbs, the vital organs, the heart, you think your mind is in your heart? Is it in the inner, outer, is it more on the skin? Is your mind in the skin, or is it inside, you know, in the inner regions? Then, so investigate to see whether your mind, thoughts, images, and so forth, actually are in the body. This would be very interesting. So many neuroscientists are saying, it's commonplace. It's everywhere in the media now. Your thoughts, images, emotions, all of them are in the brain. Okay. I find it silly. But for me to say, you're silly, doesn't actually persuade many people. Say, if you believe that, good, let's investigate. Anger is in the amygdala, right? Anger is in the amygdala. Good. Let's look for it together. That's fair enough, isn't it? You've located anger in the amygdala. When you're angry, the amygdala is activated. There's a strong correlation. Maybe they are located in the same place. Not logical in necessity, but they could be. So now let's hold hand with a neuroscientist and say, you really believe anger is in the amygdala, right? Good, let's look at the amygdala really carefully and see if we can see anger in there. What do you think you're going to find? A lot of amygdala. And not any anger at all. That's empirical. And you're not saying where anger is, you're just saying, you know, your position is not supported by the evidence. That's not scientific, is it? Let's get scientific. Let's be empirical. Let's be good scientists and not just say something because it was easy to say and nobody ever questioned us on it. Investigate well your own nature, asking this so-called mind, what you call mind. This is a really important point. Not what Buddha said or Padmasambhava said, let alone Alan Wallace, who cares what he says? When you say mind, when you refer to your mind, this so-called mind that you're calling mind, this so-called mind which recalls so many things, you remember all kinds of things with your minds, you know that, and know so much, your address, etc. Whence did you arise? If you want to really fuse your own identity with your mind, okay, your mind, you, whatever, because you're probably together, wherever your mind is, I think you must be there, right? You wouldn't leave it someplace behind, would you? So, oh, where did I put it? Where did I put it? No? Because if you're saying, where did I put it? You're asking that with your mind, so you couldn't leave it anywhere. So where your mind is, you must be there. So find yourself, find your mind. They'll be in the same place. That's very likely. Mind and brain, not so sure. But you and your mind got to be in the same location, I think. Right? Imagine you all naked with no mind at all. That'd be embarrassing. Not even wearing underwear. You're really naked. That's embarrassing. So whence did you arise? What are your characteristics? Similarly, investigate its location, the mind, and that's anything you're designating as your mind, and all the places it goes. I went down memory lane. In my imagination, I went off to Greece. I was going into the future and anticipating, what will be it like when I'm an old man? Claudio says, you don't need to look in the future. Come on, you're 65. Get real. I'm teasing him. I love to tease him. He's so much fun to tease. So in particular for articulate people and beginners, this is to be investigated meticulously. Let's finish this. We'll finish quickly. Let's keep on going because this is all of a piece. He did origins, he did location, and now he's going to go to destination. Furthermore, examine the reason why Examine the reason why the mind itself, this is cittata. Remember I talked about that earlier? Cittata. Remember that? Dhammata, ultimate nature of dharmas, phenomena. Remember? Dhammata, shunyata, emptiness. This is mindness, cittata, semyi. Semyi. Semyi is the same as rikpa. It's ultimate reality of mind. Same as rikpa. Same as Dharmakaya, same as primordial consciousness, same as Buddha nature. So that one, so I used to call it mind itself. Semyit looks a lot like mind itself. I call it something else, but there it is. Cittata. Examine the reason why the cittata, that's your Buddha nature, aka also known as Dharmakaya, right? That's your core, right? That's your ground. Examine why the mind itself, the ultimate reality of the mind, this Dharmakaya, this authentic reality, why is it that it wanders around and is deluded in the six types of sentient existence? Ring a bell, Dana. Yeah? Why? Why is it wandering around like that, like some stray dog? Your Dharmakaya, for heaven's sake, have to show some self-respect. What are you around wandering around in samsara for? You stupid. You can't be stupid or Dharmakaya. Hey, wake up. So what is its nature? Its color, its shape, or its characteristics? This thing that wanders around. Something's wandering around. We're about to wander off to the cafeteria any moment now. And your minds can go from here to there, right? So what is it that goes from here to there? That's in the meditation hall and then goes off to chow down. What is it? How did this dynamic conceptualization occur? Whence did it arise? Does it or does it not exist as a real entity, something that's real, this mind of yours? If it does, if it's real, how did it come into being? If it isn't real, if it does not come into being, it is emptiness, but what on earth does that mean? How is that so? What are you talking about? You're making noises with your mouth. Is there any reference to your speech here, or are you just kind of continuing to talk when you don't know what you're talking about? Then again, once it has come into being, okay, whew, okay, mind, okay. Once it's come into being, what are its characteristics? This mind of yours, that which you call mind, this so-called mind, what are its characteristics? Its form, its color, and so on. If it is empty, what on earth do you mean by that? Empty like a pot? If it's empty, how is it empty? Is it empty like space? Examine well how it could be empty. What do you mean? It's empty. What's that? Then again, are the mind and thoughts the same or different? Are there many thoughts in your mind? Are the thoughts themselves your mind? If thoughts are agitated, is your mind agitated? Are they the same? Are they the different? If they are the same, mind and thoughts, how do appearances and emptiness, stillness and movement become distinct? That's an interesting question. Because they are distinct. Stillness, and I'm saying instead of stability, stillness and movement. Appearances and emptiness, how do they are? They're not the same. Appearances and emptiness are not simply identical. Clearly, stillness and movement are not identical. So if mind and thoughts are the same, then how do these become distinct? When do they become distinct? If in fact they are. And where do you draw the demarcation between them? Where is the border between mind and thoughts? If they're not the same, then they must be different. If they're different, there must be something, a border, a line between them. You can say, here are thoughts, here's mind. This side, that side. Whence arose the root of delusion? How did you get deluded in the first place? Who created the duality of self and others? How did you fall into dualistic grasping? How did that take place? Examine those issues well. In that way, investigate until you have a clean, decisive question. To my mind, this is simply brilliant. Because he didn't say answer. He said question. This, when I read this, and I've had no training in Zen at all, I thought about my idealized notion of Zen. Like people working on a koan, where you come, and then you have to report. I mean, at least one person here knows. If you're the Zen Roshi, and I come back and I said, Roshi, just inconceivable. She gives me a koan. Inconceivable. No one can say. She gives me another koan. Inconceivable, you know? Well, I think we'd have a very short relationship. Because you've got to come up with something better than that. A frog can say that. I don't know quite how they'd articulate it, but a frog could say that. At least it gives it, which is inexpressible. And so he said, come up with a clear question. And that is when you come for your weekly meetings, come with a question. The clearer, the better. And then you really get someplace. Because that shows you've been doing the hard work. If you come with a clear question, you'll show him, whoever is the teacher. You'll show you're doing the work and you're not just spinning your wheels. And it's a different question each week. And you're going someplace. The question changes. Okay? Oh, yeah. So I find this quite amazing. I told you it was juicy. This is what I call juicy. Very good. Between sessions, we're now rather late, but we're going to stop. Between sessions, as you know that even there are some people a bit more hot-tempered here, like anywhere else, but even hot-tempered people are not angry all the time. You can't keep it up. Probably die of heart failure very quickly. So anger comes and goes, right? And then some people are more disposed to craving and grasping, clinging, but not all the time. It comes and goes, right? Same thing is true of delusion. We're not homogeneously through time keeping steady state of delusion. It also comes in waves, eruptions, where that seizure of the mind comes down and reifies. I or this or that. Whenever mental affliction is there, whenever any kind of mental affliction comes up, check. And that's going to be an underline. There's going to be some reification there. That's a principle in Buddhism. See whether it's true or not. But see, over the next 24 hours, if you can see the surges of reification come up. It's not even, any more than anger, craving, jealousy, or pride. It comes up, and then it subsides again. See if you can see what comes up. See if you can see it. Identify it. And then see when it subsides. That's interesting. Okay, good.